Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. The time is 2:06 p.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, in the State Capitol, room 532, on the fifth floor. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this afternoon, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good afternoon.
Senator Machicki.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
I know only Senate Finance members know that I take pleasure in doing it the introductions differently every time. Senators, we have, is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? We are continuing a conversation that we started earlier today at a previous meeting on SB 48 and HB 23. Both of those bills deal with public safety, with medical insurance premiums, survivor benefits for firefighters and peace officers who die in the line of duty. Briefly, I'd like to go through what I understand as the differences between the two bills, and then we'll have a spokesman from the administration to answer some of the questions that we had this morning. In Senate Bill 48, there is a municipal opt-in. Municipalities have the option to participate in the program, and the costs are borne by the municipalities. That's in the Senate bill. The House bill on a similar issue requires municipalities to participate, so it's a mandate. Large municipalities with a population of over 10,000 would pay the entire cost, where small municipalities would get 50% of those costs from the state. Second major issue between the two bills, in Senate Bill 48, major medical is the language that's being used, so it does not include dental or vision, and there may be other parameters defined inside of regulation. In House Bill 23, and I will provide you an overview once we have all of the issues verified. This is a preliminary. In HB 23, under medical insurance, it's asserted that there is continued coverage at the same level as employees' benefits at the time of death. We also did hear that there was the thought from the sponsor of HB 23 that members, spouses who lost their loved one a spouse who lost their loved one would be able to go in or out of the benefit, so we're going to have to clarify that. In SB 48, it excludes or appears to exclude temporary and seasonal employees, and the benefit only applies to surviving dependents of permanent full-time employees for which the employee is paid for 12 months of a year. Under House Bill 23, it includes temporary and seasonal employees. Surviving dependents of temporary or seasonal employees would be eligible for benefits. And again, we'll verify all this with law and legal to make sure that what I'm providing you in an outline this afternoon is accurate and doesn't need nuanced. Senate Bill 48, in regards to spousal benefits and the limited time of its duration, surviving spouses under the Senate bill become ineligible for the benefit after receiving the benefit for 10 years. In House Bill 23, spousal benefit limited in the duration, surviving spouses are eligible to receive the benefit until they reach the age where they're eligible for Medicare. In the Senate bill, under continued eligibility, the document requires the commissioner to annually determine the eligibility of the benefits. In House Bill 23, there is continued eligibility, but it does not require the commissioner to determine continued eligibility after the initial determination. Senator Machicki?
Could you repeat which bill had which in that, please, one more time? I'm sorry.
Certainly. The Senate bill requires the commissioner to annually determine eligibility benefits. If I recall, it was 1 year, every year. And then the House bill does not require it. After the initial eligibility is established, it continues on. In Senate Bill 48, there is no provision for pick, click, and give, that provision exists in House Bill 23. As far as the report date, in the Senate Bill 48, the commissioner would be required to determine the amount of money needed to pay the benefit annually by December 15th. In the House version, House Bill 23, the commissioner is required to determine the amount of money needed to pay the benefit annually by June 30th. That would be a calendar year issue versus a fiscal year issue for the Finance Committee. And then on the permanent ineligibility requirements, a surviving dependent becomes permanently ineligible upon becoming eligible for coverage by other means in Senate Bill number 48. In House Bill 23, permanent ineligibility, a surviving dependent does not become permanently ineligible upon becoming eligible for coverage by other means, and that's the back opting back in or losing coverage. With that, those are the primary differences that we could outline in the short period of time that we have with the support of Jordan Schilling and Lisa Weisler. So thank you for helping define for the committee and frame our conversation for this afternoon. I'd like to ask Kathy Lee from the Division of Retirement Benefits, the Chief Pension Officer, to the microphone, as well as Joan Wilkerson from Department of Law. And if we could add a third chair, if Kelly Howell, everyone may not be in the room, but if we could add a chair, if Kelly Howell is also in the room from the Department of Public Safety to address some of the questions we asked about a bit earlier. Breathe at ease. We're back on the record, Senate Finance, and it's still April 5th, 2017. Because there are many female voices at this table, if we could work through the chair and then identify yourself if we ask a question and if you're answering so that our clerks can manage the difference in voices. I try to make it flexible when we have a distinction that you can tell, or at least some would be able to tell who is speaking at a particular moment in time. The committee had several questions regarding policy. One of the questions was, should people who are not currently covered but meet eligibility requirements be able to opt in and out of a program? So the Senate is trying to understand that issue inside the existing law. Is there a particular person that would, if you could identify yourself for the record, if you're prepared to give comments on that question, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Joan Wilkerson, Department of Law. If I understand your question, is it related to the House version of the bill, House Bill 23, which allows a survivor who has established eligibility and received the premium payments and later become ineligible due to receiving insurance from another form, that person drops out of eligibility and then comes back. Is that the nature of your question?
More mechanics is what we're looking for. In the House bill, as I understand it, a person is eligible. How would we ever know that they're ineligible? They would have multiple coverage, possibly, because you only establish eligibility once. So can you tell us a process of bringing someone in and out and how under either bill, the Senate is trying to manage whether we should include in a version that may leave this body the opting in or out provision. Are there challenges to doing that? Is it easy to accommodate? If it's easy to accommodate, is there a cost associated with it? If it's easy to accommodate and it's in the bill, but it needs to be changed because there's no language that actually has re-eligibility in it under the House bill. We're just trying to find our way on the issue. So, Joan, I'm not sure that that's specific enough, but any insight that you could provide us to help shape a direction for policy would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Joan Wilkerson, Department of Law. The issue arose in the House and was addressed. And because of the language, the way it reads, the interpretation was to allow survivors to opt in and out over time. If this committee wishes more clarification, we can do an amendment and make that more clear. The Senate version of the bill, of course, made it more clear by saying, no, that would be a permanent ineligibility if people became eligible for other major medical insurance. So it's a question for this body, whether you want more clarification.
How does the department currently handle eligibility if you never have to come back and requalify for eligibility?
Since
people
this,
drop off?
Madam Chair, since this is a brand new premium payment, it's not even a benefit, it's just a premium payment. It's a new thing, and we're kind of finding our way in how this should work. But the concept was, as I mentioned earlier this morning, creating regulations which would require the applicant to apply for the benefit and indicate whether or not they have insurance at the time, because that's one of the requirements. If your question is how would we find out when they get insurance, the obligation under the current thought is up to the survivor to notify the department when they become ineligible by having other major medical insurance available to them.
Senator Machicki.
So today, if just say the House bill passes, if a spouse is currently employed and lost their loved one that is a firefighter or police officer, would they immediately not be eligible for the coverage because their coverage ends upon other similar coverage?
If the survivor has medical coverage, then the premium payment does not apply to them because it's intended for people who don't have insurance coverage.
Senator Machicki, follow up.
Do you remember or does anyone know how this was covered under Tier 1? Was eligibility something that could be returned once the survivor became ineligible?
And Senator McKitchie, through the chair, I would defer to Kathy Lee, the Chief Pension Officer for PERS, on that.
Ms. Lee, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Under Tier 1, a survivor that receives medical insurance becomes eligible at the time of the participant's death. That eligibility doesn't change. It's not dependent on whether or not they have coverage somewhere else. But if they have active coverage, their retiree coverage that they receive with their survivor benefit becomes secondary.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members on opting in or opting out? Could Senator Bishop?
I guess I'm just still a little unclear. And we're talking 23, HB 23. So it's my understanding that once they're approved by the commissioner, they're approved. Is that correct? Once they're.
Ms. Wilkerson.
Senator Bishop, through the chair. Once, if I understand correctly as well, under HB 23, once a survivor is found to be eligible for benefits, then they receive the benefits.
Okay, and I think I think, and I'm getting in trouble here, but I think this, the chair was asking, how do we know if they were to go to work or something else and become, have the option of another insurance program, would they ever become ineligible?
Well, that's a circumstance that would depend upon the survivor to notify the division.
And if I might interject, so would the regulation say that when they come sign up for these benefits? It's not my point to hold this bill up or deny anybody nothing, right? It's just I think we're here at the table and we want to get the bite at this apple as correct and as airtight as we can get it, so there is no miscommunication between the person in need. I don't want them to have to struggle or via misinterpretation. So I think we just want to make sure we're crystal clear on this, on how this works. That's all.
On this issue, I'd make a recommendation to the Senate Finance Committee that we annually review this process. It's the only way that I can see that we can verify eligibility, and it's a standard requirement for current employees. From the division of Ms. Lee, once people enter retirement, are they, since they're in a retirement status versus something active that would, I guess they could go back to work. Do they retain that that benefit?
Madam Chair, this is Kathy Lee. Yes, they do. If they are receiving survivor health benefits and they return to work with an active plan, they will continue to receive their retiree health insurance as well. It will be secondary to their active.
Okay. Any other feedback that I'm just trying to make sure that we can move forward with any changes in a relative way. If you'd prefer not to comment, I'm just choosing a direction and asking you to comment on because we need to craft something to be able to offer a CS before you. Moving on, there was an assertion from the sponsor's representative on the House bill that retroactive, there would be retroactive coverage. And we looked at an effective date of July 1st, I believe, 2017, on both bills. So I have a couple questions along those lines and certainly look to my committee to ask other questions. What is the first question would be, the sponsor's representative asserted that there was a 10-year look back. And that is not my understanding of either bill, nor is it my understanding of what the administration would pursue. And what I asked earlier was, from the Department of Law's perspective, what's defendable that we're not sued as a state if you arbitrarily choose a year? We could choose 3 years, we could choose 5, we could choose 10, we could choose back to when we started offering services. So how can we appropriately protect the state of Alaska and do what is what we should do for the people that have been affected by this gap in service since 1986?
Madam Chair, Joan Wilkerson, Department of Law. Just putting aside the concept of a 10-year look back, I'm not really sure what that expression means, so I might need some clarification from you to answer. But the way the bill was written was the triggering mechanism, rather than making it retroactive to some year, it's not triggered by the date of death, and it's not triggered by saying that it's retroactive to, say, 2013, as SB 4002 was. Rather, it's triggered by the application date. Thus, people, present survivors who've already lost family members, if they are eligible, if they apply and they are eligible, can receive benefits. And as you know, to at least under the present bill, to be eligible, they have to meet the other terms and conditions, and they also have to not have other insurance available to them. And if we look back at the number of police officers and firefighters that our state has lost over the years, we can see that most of the people that are impacted by this, because there's a very small number, most of the people impacted by this are already covered by other forms of insurance, such as PERS retirement and other forms of retirement insurance and Medicare. So we're only talking about a very small number of people that this applies to.
Ms. Wilkerson, there was an assertion, and so I'll try. In the transition language and the regulations that will be written to implement this benefit for future applicants and those that are currently covered that are in a transition period where they are at the benefit is dependent on annual appropriations by the legislative body versus a benefit that is more secure. There was an assertion that we could go back and within the last 10 years have people apply that have lost a loved one as defined under this plan. It was an assertion. If it's not in the law, that's fine. That's what we need to know. The other thing we need to know is how we're going to define under regulation who is qualified to apply for this benefit.
Madam Chair, Joan Wilkerson, Department of Law. An applicant can apply, but they can't receive a benefit except beginning July 1st, 2017. They don't receive any money. So in terms of going backwards and in terms of the practical effect, if you wish to have a date placed in this bill, then we can do that for clarification. There is none right now.
I can try one more time. Senator Machicki.
So you made the statement, if I may, Madam Chair, you made the statement earlier on that you thought it would be the application date, and I think the goal, if there's a 10-year that survives in this, I think the goal was 10 years from the date of the loss of the serving spouse. So if the effective date is July, yet we may have a few families that we want to cover, I think perhaps the question may be, how do we make it the date of the death of the individual and 10 years forward from that point instead of 10 years from the application date after July or the effective date of this bill?
Senator Machicki, that was not the question. If I could brief it ease. Hmm. We're back on the record. Thank you for that brief pause. I had an opportunity to explain my question further to Ms. Wilkerson. Ms. Wilkerson, we were talking about coverage and applications. Could you clarify?
Yes, Madam Chair. As I explained earlier, that what the state has been looking at is the actual number of state-related employee deaths. And so because they are relatively few, there's a very small number of people who would not already be covered by, for example, PERS retirement health benefits. And so we're looking at a very, very small group of people that go back maybe 3 or 4 years. If it's the desire of this committee to clarify how many years that could reasonably be addressed, we can do it through transition, or we could do it. It's a policy decision for this committee to make how we do that.
Ms. Wilkerson, and when we talked about the 45 families that have lost a loved one under state PERS, we don't really have the numbers for municipalities. Is that accurate? Is that fair for a conversation at this table? If we would mandate coverage for municipalities, there could be an unknown cost for the state versus opt-in, and there still could be an unknown cost if the language isn't clarified.
Madam Chair, for any employer that is not within the PERS system, we would not have that information to provide to this committee.
Further questions on this issue? Senator Bishop.
I just was reading here, and 7 are employees of small municipalities.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Are we ready for the next question? That's a policy consideration. I'm not making a recommendation. I'm just saying that there is a policy decision to be made there. Should off-duty officers be covered? And if so, what parameters should we set via statutes? Or should we allow this to be dealt with in regulation? Senator Dunleavy.
For the chair, obviously it's an opinion. I think if they are killed, as was mentioned earlier, in the line of duty, performing their function, performing their work. I mean, they don't, and I'm not trying to be silly, but they don't look at the watch and say, it's 6 o'clock, I'm out on the clock. It's 24/7, 365. So if they're killed in that function, I think they should fall under this. That's just my opinion.
Should people who can be covered but are not officially covered, like a spouse or a dependent, plan under a new spouse employee policy still be eligible, or should we allow families the discretion to choose their current plan? Is that not clear? Senator Bishop.
Could you just hit me with that one more time, please?
Should people who can be covered still be eligible, or should we allow families the discretion to choose their current plan? Senator Dunleavy, we're trying to capture your
question. I know, it's almost like
question.
A word game here. Is it can be covered or should be eligible, or are they eligible? I mean, can is a possibility, but are they eligible under some criterion guidelines? Is that what you're saying?
Senator Dunleavy, we've tried to capture your questions, so if we don't have it right,
can is a possibility of unlimited parameters, but if there's eligibility guidelines, and they fall under those eligibility guidelines that are spelled out.
If I could ask Ms. Luckett to the microphone. Ms. Lucky.
For the record, Julie Lucky, staff to Senator McKinnon. This is an issue that was asked of the sponsors. It was not on the record, but there was some clarification that we thought should be made by this committee. And the issue is one of if a person gets remarried and their spouse has a plan, there are many plans that allow for an optional family coverage versus just a primary person. So that person in that case, the employee, the new spouse, would be covered. But then the person who is currently covered under the surviving I'm sorry, I don't know how to make this more clear. If there's a surviving spouse and then maybe gets married to someone, that person would be covered by their employee plan but would have to pay an additional premium in order to cover the surviving spouse and those dependent children. And so, therefore, in that case, the spouse is not automatically covered because they would be opting in and maybe paying a higher premium. It was very unclear whether the bill, because of the word eligibility, is that is the surviving spouse now eligible for that plan, even though a premium would have to, an additional premium would have to be paid by the worker, the employer, or should that be somebody that could choose to say, we don't want to pay into the new plan because that would be additional cost, and we would like to stick with the surviving benefit that we have. When this was discussed, it was thought it could be dealt with in regulation, but it is unclear in the statute whether that statute would allow that, and so what the question is to ask for the committee's clarification on that circumstance. And I'm not sure if that was clearer. I'm happy to answer any clarifying questions.
Ms. Lucky, that was clearer. Thank you. Ms. Wilkerson, any comments from the Department of Law on how we might clarify that, the policy point?
If the point is to expand upon what's in the present bill, which renders ineligible someone who becomes eligible for other medical insurance, but if it's the policy decision of this body to make exceptions to that, then yeah, it would require an amendment.
Thank you. Other questions from committee members? A policy and decision for your consideration. Should we allow this policy to become secondary so that it is not creating a disincentive for marriage or job promotion with benefits? Senator Michicki.
So I think for me there are two questions. Whether or not we allow eligibility to become reinstated if someone loses a job or insurance. Both bills currently say right now that they become ineligible for premium payments once the surviving spouse becomes eligible to receive major medical insurance coverage by other means, right? I think if you allowed someone to become once again eligible once they were ineligible for an amount of time, it kind of solves that problem. So in my view, our goal here is to have a safety net for survivors of a firefighter or police officer that's lost in the line of duty. We're providing that safety net. If they become ineligible, I believe in the ineligibility if they are able to obtain other insurance. And perhaps for whatever time we specify, they should be allowed to become eligible once again if they were to lose that insurance. Again, just focusing on that safety net that this bill provides.
Senator Von Imhoff, followed by Senator Dunleavy.
To build on Senator Michicki, it would make sense that within the 10-year limit, which we have for Senate Bill 48, that in the event that a spouse wants to opt in or opt out for whatever reason, it might make sense within that 10 years. Circumstances can change, both good and bad, within a decade. And maybe within a 10-year period, if they need to opt back in, they ought to be able to.
Senator Dunleavy.
I don't know if the concept is embedded, but the teeing off of what Senator Michicki was saying, would it be comparable insurance, meaning you may get a job, but the insurance may not be anywhere near comparable? And is that a disincentive to maybe get that particular job because the insurance would be less than they have a surviving spouse, there's young children, they're going to get a job to try and make this work, but what happens if the insurance ends up being not anywhere near comparable? That may be a disincentive to... There's a lot of monkey wrenches we can throw in this. I'm just thinking being comparable.
Dunleavy, it's an excellent question. It's a balance. In my meeting with one of the individuals who testified before us this morning, there was an assertion that in her particular case, that their family made an active choice to continue on beyond the 20 years to seek the benefit of the 5 more years of employment to secure health benefits for the family. And so that individual was advocating that it was that we should try from her family's position to look at this as a retirement benefit that would be secured versus an ongoing employee relationship. And I'm sure that she can correct us on the record if I'm not asserting that appropriately. But so I think that certainly the in and out would be something from the conversation that I had with that family that would be of benefit. But the 10 years is seen as less of a benefit than in the House bill, where it's not defined based on a limited number of years. So those are all important questions to consider.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
I just have to say how this struck me originally. My understanding is that every family has had their premiums paid by someone in the last several years. But what struck me was when these stories came out was the fear of the family of losing their coverage at the end of the month. I think we can spend a lot of time on details, exhaustive details of what that should look like. I think our focus should be on ensuring that families, surviving families from a loss of firefighters or law enforcement, have an adequate safety net for reasonable coverage. And I think both of these bills have pieces of that. I think if you go far beyond that, you are perhaps creating a disincentive to moving on at some point. And a lot of factors can throw in the age of the family and the age of what happens when the loss occurs, right? You have to think of the whole spectrum and where a responsible safety net is laid out for across most of that lifespan spectrum and the age of the children and stuff. But that's what I keep focusing on. I was surprised that we didn't have coverage for someone who was lost in the line of duty. I'm not sure that anyone's asking for a Cadillac plan for the rest of their life. I think they're looking for adequate coverage and to know that that's not something those families have to worry about if they do lose someone.
I would throw out for your consideration, when I lost a family member, my second mom, a few years ago, the effort to get a death certificate was almost insurmountable in this state. So I believe that a 30-day application period is too short. And so I would throw out to the committee that a spouse and family are dealing with many things. And if you have to have a death certificate to acquire benefits, given the fact that a murder or something else with a peace officer or a firefighter in determining eligibility or even acquiring the simple task of a death certificate, that we may want that application or their benefits extended longer than the 30 days than is currently in either bill. So I just say, as someone who tried to acquire a death certificate and bury someone through cremation, that it was 3 weeks before I saw a death certificate for anyone. So to have an application come in a family that is in crisis, so with the loss of a loved one, seems unrealistic. So I would ask the Division of Benefits or the Department of Law, how can we make that happen in this bill so that there is transition? Senator Michicki asked for big ticket items, and I think it's you're asking an awful lot for a family in crisis to be trying to get an application for health care in 30 days if they don't even have a death certificate in hand. And I hounded the folks who I was following that death certificate every step of the way, and actually in the legislature Not that that should mean anything, and it did not mean anything, but I couldn't believe that a simple request of a death certificate could take so long.
I think we were, Madam Chair, Joan Wilkerson, Department of Law, I think in writing this brand new premium payment program, we were trying to set up a matrix, knowing that there would be more conversation about what would be an appropriate amount of time for things, and we're just trying to start with something, and we came up with 30 days, and if this body thinks that we need more time, then we could do that. In the Senate version of the bill, since that is written to presume that the person is eligible, because it, in recognizing that it does take time to get the application in and consider it and everything, there's a presumption that the eligibility attaches so that the payment can begin right away. And so depending on what version of the bills this body wants to end up with, that you might want to take that into account if you wish to extend that period of time.
Senator Machicki.
I have a new question, so if you're pursuing that, I can wait.
Well, I just was looking for feedback. It's an idea I had when I heard the testimony earlier today, and knowing the struggle of the death certificate, I don't know how that affects. We're presuming that someone is qualified for a benefit, which means we're expending state dollars to provide insurance coverage. So we could, right now, the risk would be that you covered someone, an entire family, for 1 month, and they did not qualify for the benefit. And so I am proposing a minimum of 45 days to 2 months for that requirement, just because I have walked through the process of experiencing a loss, nothing traumatic as the families that we're talking about, and I struggled to get a death certificate by the three-week marker. So I just want to be reasonable in the approach, but if the committee believes that 30 days is the right number, I'm happy to move that forward. I just want to make sure that our families have enough time to process what's going on and to identify that there's a potential problem in their coverage. If you would contact me privately, send me an email, whether you're in support or in opposition. I'll take that under advisement for our next meeting. Senator Machicki.
So while we have folks that have some knowledge about state insurance options, Senate Bill 48 allows for major medical insurance coverage, and House Bill 23 allows for the existing or continued coverage at the current level. Can you describe the differences between those two levels, and for us to help us decide where we believe the benefit should land in this bill?
Senator McKitchy, through the chair, Joan Wilkerson, Department of Law, and the reason that I'm responding instead of Ms. Lee is that Ms. Lee's area of specialization is pension, and I'm afraid that while we wish we had our chief health official here today, she's out ill. So I'm going to step in and simply repeat information that we provided to the House Finance Committee in response to the same question. And that is that when in putting this bill together, we had three words that we used as adjectives. We had health insurance, medical insurance, or major medical insurance. And those were the adjectives that we were working with. And come to find out that there's Alaska statutes on that define health insurance. It's very broad. It includes all kinds of things that aren't intended under this bill. For example, it could include stop-loss insurance, dismemberment, accidental death, disability, things that would not apply here. Major medical insurance is also defined at Alaska Statute 2155514, and major medical insurance includes dental, or vision care if they are included within a medical policy, but it does not include standalone dental and vision. It is basically the nuts and bolts medical coverage. And frequently, in common parlance, is considered to be more restrictive than the term medical, which is what the House decided on. They decided on the definition using the word medical. The word medical insurance is not defined in Alaska statute, but it's commonly used in the insurance industry, as you probably know, to encompass major medical and can include plans that have dental and vision coverage as well. So it's a little bit more expansive than major medical, which has a tendency to not include things like preventive care.
Senator Michiki, follow up.
I didn't hear that discussion from those that testified that are most knowledgeable today, as the things that I heard were not related to the type of these two types of insurance. It was more safety net related, and I heard more discussions about the term of coverage or the length of time of coverage and that sort of thing. So perhaps it's not as important as knowing the answer right now.
Senator Michiki, we all hear things differently. What I remember from the public testimony is that at least the spouse who testified directly appreciated the language of the medical insurance that provided the standalone policies. I believe that several people testified in favor of the House, and then several people testified in favor of the Senate bill. I think you're right that, but I believe that the person who I had a meeting with was advocating specifically, and we spoke about the medical insurance side when I visited with her. Senator Dunleavy.
Brief at ease. I know we always call it brief at ease, but it will be.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Dunleavy, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, we're just looking at the difference between the two bills, and I'm just trying to think where a lot of discussion going on. One of the bills has a concept of continuation of care. And just my thought that that concept of continuation of care, in other words, if the spouse was still surviving, that health plan would be the health plan the family would be under a certain or lengthy existence of time. And I'm just thinking instead of building a new plan, and I'm not suggesting that's what the center of the conversation was or the focus of the conversation, but the plan would take care of the, if it's a continuation of care of the plan itself would take care of some of these questions, I think.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. We had a question earlier. There is a reason for you to be here, Ms. Lee. What are disability benefits for someone who, I hope this is a question for you, what are disability benefits for someone injured, or is that Department of Law again?
I'm Madam Chair Kathy Lee from the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Yes, that is a question for me, so yay.
Thank you.
Get to answer something I know. In the defined benefit tiers, there is both occupational and non-occupational disability. Someone who is injured on the job and whose disability is tied directly to their work can become eligible for an occupational disability benefit. They receive 40% of their salary in the month in which they were disabled. They will continue to receive that disability benefit until they reach normal retirement, either age or service eligibility. They continue to earn membership service while they're receiving disability benefits, and they do receive medical benefits as well.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
That was Tier 1. Is that what you did? I'm sorry, I missed the very first part.
Through the chair, that would be Tiers 1, 2, and 3.
1, 2, and 3, okay. I do have another question.
Senator Bishop.
And Tier 4?
Under Tier 4, through the chair, Senator Bishop, under Tier 4, the member, if they have an occupational disability, will receive the same benefit as far as the pension goes. They will receive 40% of their salary, their full salary for the month in which they were disabled. They will continue to earn service while they're receiving those disability benefits. In addition to that, the employer must pay both the employee contribution and the employer contribution that they would have paid if the member was still working into their investment account. They cannot distribute from that investment account while they're receiving disability benefits. When they reach normal retirement age by either age or service, then the disability benefits will stop, and they will have access to their investment account. For peace officers and firefighters, they can elect to continue receiving a monthly benefit. And when they are Medicare eligible or when they reach 25 years of service, they can access the defined contribution retirement plan health benefits.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. There was a comment earlier about Tier 1 language that used to provide for the benefits that we're talking about today. Do you know what language changed when we went from Tier 1 to Tier 2 that precluded surviving spouses from receiving the benefits?
Madam Chair, Kathy Lee with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The surviving spouse is eligible for benefits in all tiers. Whether or not they pay the premium is what changed with Tier 2. Under Tier 1, the medical came to them at no cost. Under Tier 2, they had to pay the premium if they were under age 60. And that came in an addition to the statute in Section C. Originally, there was only a Section A and B to AS 3935, 535 that talked about medical eligibility. When that change came in, language was added in Section C that persons receiving benefits that were under age 60 would have to pay the full monthly premium. And so that's the change that happened between Tier 1 and Tier 2. And that exists for Tier 3 as well, except Tier 3 has an additional requirement of having to, the member would have had to have 10 years of membership service to be eligible.
Senator Bishop?
I wanted to ask a question, but I don't know if I might. I'm just going to ask it. So if we were under Tier 1 now in these people that we're wanting to cover now, would we even be sitting here having this conversation? If Tier 1 still applied for these people, we wouldn't be here having this conversation, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct. The changes that came with Tier 2 and 3 were cost containment measures for the plan.
Okay, so there is a template out there under Tier 1 on survivor benefits.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct. We can remove the requirement for a survivor to have to pay for premiums. That does come with a price tag with it. Under the retiree plan, and you know, we would have to have an actuarial study to find out what that would be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. I think the conversation in the previous legislative cycle was that opening and changing tier 2, 3, or 4 would reopen the entire benefits conversation, and that the legislature was not interested in doing that. Because, as Ms. Lee said, they were cost containment measures for the plan, or the plans. I'm trying to go through, I have two more questions. If children are covered under the age of 26, is there additional costs for the surviving parent because of the family plans that we have? We can't quantify that yet. I believe.
Madam Chair, with the Chief Health Official home ill today, we were not able to get an answer for that question today, but we do plan on getting you that response as soon as we're able.
Thank you. And then, Kelly Howell, we do have a question for Department of Public Safety. In the bill, in both bills, in both bills, it has the Department of Public Safety as the administrator of this program. And I had asked at the earlier meeting today why the Department of Administration is not managing the plan. If I could hear from Public Safety, and then Ms. Wilkerson, I believe that you can answer the technical. Kelly, do you have anything for us to consider why a Department of Public Safety is here on the eligibility side of the house?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Public Safety. Currently, the Department of Public Safety is paying the medical insurance premiums for three of the surviving families that would be eligible under both versions of this bill. The Department of Public Safety already has established policies and protocols for these types of situations. There is a coordinator that's assigned to the family of the deceased employee, and that person, who is a member of the department, is responsible to assist the family in identifying and accessing all of the assistance and resources that are available to them. So, Madam Chair, as you described your experience in obtaining the death certificate, that is the role of the coordinators, to assist the family in accomplishing those tasks. This would be one of the additional tasks that we envision that coordinator doing, is assisting the family in accessing this premium payment program. We believe also that the Department of Public Safety is uniquely situated in that, I remember exactly where I was when Gila 1 crashed. I remember exactly where I was when we had the tragedy in Tanana. Public safety and law enforcement in general is a tightly knit community, tightly knit family oriented organization, and like all of my other fellow employees in the department, we feel like we have a more unique and sensitive understanding of these situations and can provide maybe a more appropriate response, if you will, and support to those families.
Ms. Howell, before we get to the technical nature of the request, so you're prepared to take on university police from DOT, university, international, airport police, parole officers, and correction officers as a new responsibility in Department of Public Safety?
Madam Chair, we hope that this the number of eligible families under this legislation will remain small, so we're not anticipating that this is going to be overly burdensome for the department to administer. Obviously, we will be monitoring that, but at this point, you know, we are very hopeful for a solution this legislative session, and we are willing to accept the additional responsibilities that come along with assisting the other families under this program.
Thank you. Ms. Wilkerson, do you have comments from the Department of Law's perspective of why Department of Public Safety is the appropriate place to house this program?
Madam Chair, I would largely echo the previous testimony, and I would also point out that all of our agencies do a certain degree of administering programs. Every agency of the executive branch administers programs. So it's pretty typical that it would be, the DPS would be administering just another program. In addition, when we think of administering a benefit, we naturally think of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. But it just so happens that the employees of the Division of Retirement and Benefits, their pay is largely funded through retirement trusts and health trusts. So to take on an additional responsibility of this nature that isn't tied to those trusts would require the creation, undoubtedly, of new PCNs that were funded under the general fund. So it just seemed more logical to put it under DPS.
Thank you. We had additional questions on coverage for unborn children. Stepchildren are already covered, I believe, so on whatever iteration. I would like feedback from committee members whether they want that included in a CS, and we will be working on transition language for transition for coverage of families currently covered. Is there anything else? Any other questions that the committee needs answered? Ms. Wilkerson, Ms. Lee, Ms. Howell, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. We appreciate your additional information for our consideration.
Thank you.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? I did pass out during the short or the brief at ease a document from Legislative Research. It's titled Medical Benefits for the Surviving Dependents of Law Enforcement Officers and Firefighters Killed in the Line of Duty. It's an analysis from other states on what their current, how they currently handle the survivor spouse benefit issue. Senator Donnelly.
I don't know if I should mention this, but if you do a little research on crime rates across the country, we vie for Louisiana with the highest crime rate in the country, and our violent crimes are probably near the top. And I'm not just throwing this out there, but it is interesting. Vermont's about 99 crimes per 100,000 people. Alaska, according to one statistic, is 632 per 100,000 people. It is a risky job, and I think we're going to come to some resolution here that I think folks will be happy with, but also protect our first responders.
Senator Machikin.
No comments, Madam Chair.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? Tomorrow at 9 a.m. we'll have SB 87, School Construction Energy Efficiency Standards, and SB 96, Education. It's an education bill regarding schools, teachers, and funding. With that, we're adjourned.